Hello, I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hi, everybody.
Hey. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hello.
And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hello.
To help give you a sense of the real essence of our panel, I'm going to go around the studio and have each of you tell me, what was your favorite film when you were 14 years old? Wappler.
Say Anything. It was the height of my John Cusack crush, and this just nailed it in hard. Also, I'm from Chicago. This was a big Chicago movie because everyone knew who John Cusack was and Jeremy Piven and that whole scene, so it was very rewarding.
Winter Mitchell.
Well, I have to just dedicate this to Jim Carrey because Jim Carrey had The Mask, Ace Ventura, and Dumb and Dumber. In 1994, I feel like I was watching a Jim Carrey movie a week with my lunch money.
Oliver.
The movie I want to say is Aliens, but in truth, I only started watching it when my college roommate and guy and my mutual friend Josh Greenbrook had it on Laserdisc in 1991, and we would watch it with all the extras. The movie that I actually watched to death in 86 was probably, and I'll still ride for it, was Star Trek The Voyage Home, the one with the whales.
Oh, God, it's so good.
It is.
It's so
It really is.
Good.
Slept on.
Oh, God.
I'm a fish called Wanda. I was getting to stay up late that summer and watch late night shows, and there were these amazing panelists on all the late night shows, and then I learned what Monty Python was, but A Fish Called Wanda was even better because it was a caper comedy, and it had America's favorite, possibly intersex Jewess, Jamie Lee Curtis. It was everything I wanted. All right, coming up on this week's show, HBO's Looking has been described as a gay version of Sex and the City or Girls. We'll be getting into that. Later, we'll all be sharing our top culture recommendations. But first, what arts and entertainment news has been worthy of our attention over the last 7 days? Margaret, what have you been all about this week?
Well, I've been very fascinated by this crazy haul that American Sniper brought in over MLK weekend. So it made more than $90 million in its wide release debut, and it just shattered records for a January release. By contrast, Selma is lagging behind at $26 million in ticket sales total. And I just find this very interesting, what the viewing habits, what the choice was this weekend for moviegoers. There's so much to talk about with American Sniper, but just to sort of touch on some of the points that happened with it on Twitter. Both Michael Moore and Seth Rogen, they've stirred up some controversy with some tweets, criticizing it, or at least criticizing the idea of the sniper as a hero. Michael Moore in particular said, you know, snipers are cowards, they'll shoot you in the back. And that prompted a conservative response from our favorite conservative, Newt Gingrich. So it's interesting to me about this film, for one thing, and we're going to get into this, I know, when we talk about biopics with Oliver's topic. But usually I feel like movies are criticized for leeching out the complexity in a character. And in this case, and I haven't seen American Sniper, but I've read a lot of reviews of it. There is more complexity put into the Chris Kyle character. He's more morally gray, in a gray area. Whereas, according to his memoir, and he's, you know, the most lethal sniper in U.S. history, according to his memoir, he thought killing was fun. He had no regrets. He said, you know, Iraqis are monsters, savages, so forth and so on. So in the movie, he's not quite that black and white. So I think that's interesting that that was a choice that was made by Clint Eastwood, kind of writing it on both lines. But I actually think it would have been more interesting to show Chris Kyle as the man he really was, because that man does make a good soldier and a bad man in a lot of ways.
It's so interesting. I mean, also coming off of the question about movies from when we were 14 is we all grew up with Vietnam movies sort of like creating the popular myth of this war. And it's been so weird, like with Zero Dark Thirty and Black Hawk Down, not Black Hawk Down, The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Watching these movies tell us about a war that we were all adults to see happen and continue this myth of sort of like, you know, while we'll talk about complexity and about how those Arabs are people, in the long run, it's all about big, strong, white American men killing people because that's what they got to do.
I thought it was really interesting that Seth Rogen found a way to get into the conversation when he just made a movie that nearly collapsed a studio. Mm-hmm. I just feel like this has nothing at all, Margaret, to do with
that's
with
still not proven. Though. That is still not proven, though, I have to say.
Okay, I'm just saying that, like, now's not the time, Seth. But to your point and what you brought up, like, you mentioned earlier about why people went to see this versus going to see Selma. And look, I mean, I think just even going off of the Oscar nominations, sort of the controversy over the whiteout of that, I think we're aware that you kind of know what you're going to get when you go to see Selma.
Mm-hmm.
And this is to take nothing away from Dr. King's legacy, but it's just like, you know what you're going to see, you know what you're going to hear. But I would like to see this, the American Sniper, because it's Clint Eastwood and because it's Bradley Cooper. But I also really want, I also felt like I needed to support Selma more than that.
I feel like that's such an interestingly apt comparison. Because, like, the civil rights movie is a trope that we know, and it's a trope that's, like, 40 years old now. And so however much we understand Selma will probably be good.
If you've never heard about anybody else in civil rights history other than in school, growing up, elementary school, high school, you heard about Martin Luther King. So yeah. You kind of know. This is sort of like a new agey, you know, a memoir like his is a very unique, specific thing that's affecting a lot of people, just like the civil rights movement, but it's recent history.
I would just add, though, I mean, I think with American Sniper, I already know just based on the previews what I'm going to get. It's going to be about someone who shoots people from a distance using a sniper rifle and is going to be conflicted about it because all you see in the previews is how haunted he is by this and blah, blah, blah. And he's got a family at home and he's going to have trouble integrating. I mean, I'm not dogging it, but to the extent that we can predict what the movie is about, American Sniper to me doesn't seem like it's hiding any secrets in that respect.
No, but it's very conscious of it. They were conscious of making it that way.
Right, right. But I'm saying if the predictability of Selma, I mean, most people know of King because of the "I Have a Dream" speech, which comes years later after, comes years after Selma. It's a moment in civil rights history, which I think if you study civil rights history, yeah, you know Selma, but it's less, to me, it's less obvious than, let's say, the Montgomery bus boycott because of Rosa Parks, and everyone's mm-hmm. learned that at some extent. And I haven't seen either movie, so that I'm kind of operating a bit in the dark here. But with Selma, from what I understand, a lot of it's really just about the tactics, which actually makes it much more of a dramatic film in terms
right.
of how they actually strategizing it, as opposed to it's not just one, like, rousing speech after another, though I'm sure there's going to be at least one rousing speech after
No, but there was a lot of what I will say about Selma is I grew up hearing the story, learning the story, knowing the story because I had the wonderful pleasure of having a mother who was very into her own history and passed that on to my sister and I. So I heard this story a lot. So it's just like, you know, you'll still go see a really good version of Red Riding Hood. You've heard the story a lot. You know what I mean? Like, you know, but you can sort of give or take one or the other if you miss the Amanda Seyfried version.
I mean, this goes back to Margaret's point, though. I understand why the two films are being compared, but on the flip side, I don't understand why the two films are being compared, only insofar as they're completely different films. So, yeah, anyways.
Oh, I wanted to make a Red Riding Hood joke. My President Johnson, what big congressional clout you have. Sorry. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
Scott Salt's new biography of Richard Pryor, which is called Becoming Richard Pryor, just came out about a month or two ago. And it is I don't want to claim it's the definitive biography of Richard Pryor, but it might very well be. I mean, it's incredibly comprehensive. It delves much, much deeper into his childhood in Peoria than a lot of other biographies have done. And Scott, who is a professor at Berkeley, also delves a lot into Pryor's 7 months in Berkeley, which is his period, kind of a crucial crossroads in the comedian's career that is pretty much lost to a lot of other biographies. People just didn't know a lot about it. And he managed to track down Pryor's roommate of the time back then and talked to a lot of other people who interacted with Pryor in the Bay Area. And as Saul argues,
that was his shift to politicization, right?
I mean, it all comes in bits and pieces, sure. But Berkeley seems to be really pivotal in this in terms of the stand-up that he was before versus the kind of actor, writer, and comedian he was after. Berkeley falls right in the middle of that transition.
Yeah.
So whether Berkeley was 100% responsible for that, I don't know if Scott would make that claim. But it definitely seems to be this point in which he's radicalized. He's come into contact with black intellectuals like Ishmael Reed and Cecil Brown. And this all plays into his evolution as a comedian. Yeah.
That's awesome. I worked on a like black late night show like 2 years ago, and they would tell stories of sort of like early Pryor, who was essentially just a Cosby ripoff.
Right. Which surprised me. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I have to look into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Winner, what are you all about this?
I wanted to say something about Richard
Pryor. Oh, sorry.
Pryor.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Waiting to finish the conversation. Jesus.
Bad host.
did they talk at all about my favorite moment of Richard Pryor's career? Like, this is just kind of where he got into my consciousness because I wasn't allowed to watch the racier stuff. Mm-hmm. But, like, the toy.
You know, actually, no. He actually purposefully does not focus on the 80s output much because for him, by that point,
he made some.
That's so much more known by everyone.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
but it's
Superman
also less
3.
Artistically interesting, is how Saul would argue.
Sure. Okay.
But no, that's a good period to focus on in and of itself, just prior in the 80s.
Prior in the, because that's
the toy,
like the onset
Superman,
of the sick, of the illness, you know, like, and, you know, they were good movies, but he basically Chris Tuckered himself. He just sort of blew himself.
But,
ooh. Shots fired. Ooh, sorry, Chris. Love you.
But there was also an awesome way that he sort of understood that, like, the fire did not burn as bright in him, like, that he wasn't as angry and sort of reached out to Eddie Murphy and sort of said, like, hey, you do what you're doing. And I'm all, like, I recently rewatched Eddie Murphy's Bad, which was one of, like, my...
Bad?
No, not
Raw?
Bad. Raw.
Woo.
Sorry. I just confused black men
Eddie
with,
Jackson.
three-letter... Okay, sorry. Point comes down to... First 8 minutes of just being grossed out by gay people. And it was just so weird to, like, watch this.
So weird to watch.
Forgotten about that.
I watched that recently.
But also, I can never say that it wasn't the thing that made me want to be a stand-up comedian. I can't say that it isn't the thing that, like, taught me what I think a comedian should be on a stage. But it also taught me that I was gross and disgusting. And, like, it's so interesting. I'm making this about me. The point is that, like, he really did just sort of, like, say, Eddie Murphy... You're the kid now. Go
like,
do that.
Pass the baton.
I'm going to make some cash.
Right. One other thing. I had no idea that he was one of the key writers on Blazing Saddles, but now it makes so much sense.
Yeah. I believe that there was some sort of, like, tension or something about, like, him being pissed off that,
he didn't get cast.
I'm not sure if it was that or just sort of, like, crediting or what. But
yeah,
I think it was crediting.
Well, I think both. I mean, he really wanted to be – he thought he was writing the role for himself.
Oh, really? Wow.
And then I think – was it Warner Brothers? I forget what studio put up Blazing Saddles, but they're like – they'd already heard about his sort of drug fueled antics on other movies. They're like, no way in hell. And so
we're gonna switch out to a better Negro.
Ouch.
Poor Cleavon Little. He did such strong work. All right, winner.
Rest in peace, Cleavon.
Now, are you ready to tell us what you're all about this week?
Oh, I'd love to talk about this. Naya Rivera, okay, who's like the fourth lead on Glee. Decides that she's going to speak on behalf of all ethnic people and say that we don't wash our ass on The View, which I would be more concerned about if there was more people still watching The View.
Yeah.
But because it was so overtly just thrown out to be controversial and maybe hopefully angle for a job.
How did that topic come up?
Yeah, I don't even know.
I want to know this.
I don't even know how the topic came up because I refuse to do anything more than just read the
View
story.
Is like a wasteland now. The View
it's
is
a
like
wasteland.
It's a demilitarized zone. Like they were.
I still want to be on that show.
A good 10 years where the shit was always going down on the
point.
View, and it was always exciting. And like bringing Rosie back was a mistake because there's no one big and strong enough to fight back against her.
She's a scary lady.
It's a mess now.
But look, more importantly, I wash myself a minimum of twice a day. if that's too much information, you can turn it off now.
But this is also the terrible situation of you having to sort of like
even explain that.
Yes, like, explain yourself. Like
I'm doing it as a courtesy, and I'm also doing it as a brand positioning for myself.
Because, oh, I love that.
Because
I just
building
want you to be
platform
aware. Yeah, building
on
my
hygiene.
Thank
if
you.
There are
Wobbler.
Moisturizers or
there
hair products.
There is a whole lot. There is an excessive amount because everyone that I know that's fabulous and amazing in this industry has a closet completely dedicated to the cleanings of one's whatever. I was going to say the P word, but that was not appropriate.
But Naya
my mom is listening.
Naya Rivera is having to fight for relevance in a world where Glee is barely relevant and she's barely part of Glee.
She's not even on the show anymore. And there's so many things that keep happening with her where I'm like, where are you going with this?
Not to hijack, but will anyone have a post-career acting-wise off that show?
Lea Michele.
You think?
Yeah.
She's got talent and can always go back to Broadway. And I think Chris Colfer is well-positioned to be a personality, if not an actor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Jane Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she had one before.
Right. Oh, you're talking about the kids.
I don't watch. I never have been able to get through a single episode.
It's insufferable. You guys.
I read for the first two seasons.
The first season was charming. It was exciting when they were like, oh, they have real gay kids. And then it's like, these are not real children. And now everyone's
gay. One of the best straight fathers of gay children ever.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not cliche at all.
Okay, you guys, we're starting a new segment where if we collectively all vote, we are going to fire someone from the zeitgeist. And I would like to propose now
Glee.
That Naya Rivera.
Oh, Naya Rivera.
But was she ever part of the zeitgeist, though?
Yeah, but I would argue no.
Okay.
She doesn't have the household name cred.
So it's a misuse of our grand authority.
Exactly. We don't want to waste this willy-nilly.
I
want to
throw Glee into the entire pit.
Throw Glee into the entire pit.
Yeah,
I feel
like,
behind that.
But isn't Glee already out of the zeitgeist?
No.
When's the last time someone said, yo, Glee?
I see it on Twitter at least once or twice.
It's possible that someone just needs to slide a blade through that neck.
Okay.
Whoa.
Are you...
Guy?
Okay.
Margaret Wappler.
Yes, sir.
Are you willing to say Glee is no longer part of the zeitgeist?
I was willing to say that so early on. Yes.
Winter Mitchell.
You know my position. Yes.
Well, I just assumed it was already out, so clearly yes.
All right. Glee, you're not a TV show anymore. You've been canceled by us. You're fired.
Was that the TMZ?
That was the gun going into it.
That was the gun.
Can I volunteer Matthew McConaughey for a future discussion?
Yes.
No.
I love
McConaughey. The torso holds up. He's fine. All right, you guys. This week, I am now the person who got on the transparent bandwagon. I'm sorry that I took so long. I wish I could talk about something else because we've talked about it so much, but it is the thing that I am all about this week, and I would like to make it specifically about Judith Light and her bones and shoulders.
When she sits in a chair
and is just being that osteoporosis of an older Jewish woman.
It's just when you say it, I see it. Without having never seen the show.
The thing is, it was so easy for so long to just think of her as that person from Who's the Boss, which was a silly show. And then she was in all of those Lifetime movies. And it's easy to ignore that she picked up 2 Tony Awards since then.
Yeah.
And like on a show where there are a lot of fireworks and a lot of things going on and everyone's fascinating, that on a show with complexity, you get someone who's kind of the villain, but who also... is more sensitive and aware of other people than anyone else on this show.
You think Judith is set up as kind of the villain?
I feel like I go into it with a presumption of this is the woman who was holding Maura back.
Oh, I see.
And she is sort of so trite in her estimation of Maura. He's got his little kink, you know? He's stuffing himself into my panties.
But it feels apt for that time. Like, that's the way a woman like that would approach it. Like, okay, he's got this weird little thing. I'm going to indulge it a little bit and giggle with my friends over white wine about it.
Right.
But that's as far as it's going to go.
I will say, especially about Light specifically, I really do enjoy seeing actors who we associate with one definitive role be able to reinvent themselves. So whether it's Judith Light on Transparent or, yeah, I mean, I've been... Well,
or
I just
Jeffrey
finished...
Tambor for that.
Yeah.
Well, I feel matter. Like the... But though I do feel like the jump from Arrested Development to Transparent makes a lot of sense.
I'm talking about when he was the lascivious, like, perv boss to, I think, Chrissy or Jack on Three's Company.
And, he was on Three's Company?
Yes. And he was
oh,
all...
Gosh.
And yes.
Oh, shit.
That's
you just
taking
blew my
it
mind.
Way back.
Yeah, yeah, dude. And I'm
That's
younger than you. That's
or,
a career.
Or Kerry Russell going from Felicity to The Americans, which is... Or, I mean, my favorite is still... is. Oh, God, what's her name from Married with Children to Sons of Anarchy?
Katie Sagal is so talented.
I mean, that,
Michelle Williams.
Holy crap.
Well, I mean, we just forget that these people.
From Destiny's Child?
No, sorry.
no, Michelle Williams.
Yeah
from Dawson's Creek.
From Dawson's Creek, exactly. Yeah.
But these people that...
They're both named Michelle Williams.
You just...
Zing!
You think of Katie Sagal as a character, and you don't necessarily think of her as being an extremely capable actress. And then you're like...
She played Peggy Bundy and had two miscarriages.
Kate, I thought we were going back to Dawson's.
Oh.
In which case, we're talking about different Katie. Never mind, my bad.
Two miscarriages and played Peggy Bundy with vigor every day.
She's amazing. She has sisters who are twins who started in a short-lived 1983 sitcom that I fucking loved when I was seven.
Double Trouble.
I love that. I've been searching online. Like,
that was
Double
my
Trouble?
Ish. I
where
looked for a DVD
it?
Of it. They've been working
oh
on
Oh, my
it.
God,
it's
you guys.
Yes.
Did I miss this? I clearly missed this.
Oliver, get with it.
Wow.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about HBO's gay comedy drama. That's generous. Both of those.
It
looking
is neither.
After this.
Hey, Max Fun listeners. I'm Dave Holmes. And if you've been missing my show, International Waters, then you've been missing this.
Gotta stick together. Philip, got to stick
Why
together.
Are you cupping it's my family. Balls?
It's family, Philip. It's family.
Don't squeeze them so tight, Miss Pop. Oh, Jesus,
I'm
it hurts.
I'm doing this in the name of...
I'm so sorry.
So sorry. So sorry about that.
I withdraw from the round.
That was a beautiful stage greeting of 9 to 5.
International Waters, a panel show where U.S. and U.K. comedians battle for pop culture supremacy. Subscribe right now on iTunes or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio...
Oh, I'm sorry, Oliver Wang.
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And we're going to stop discussing Courtney Cox being in that Bruce Springsteen video to talk about something much, much more boring. You guys, last year HBO premiered a new show that was purported to be the gay male answer to Girls. Three guys in a city trying to figure out life and love. It seemed like an exciting premise for a TV show. After decades of having to identify with the women on Golden Girls, Sex and the City, or Girls, we'd finally have a show of our own, made by gay writers with gay actors, and the HBO liberty to show all the butt sex they wanted. And that show was terrible. From the first moment Patrick tried to strike up conversation with a guy he was cruising in the bushes. That doesn't happen, you guys. The show had a remarkably tin ear for gay culture and American pop culture sensibilities more generally. The show's earnest desire to throw off the campy legacy of Will and Grace was understandable, but amongst gay men, earnestness... never the best quality. It's not going to get you far. Looking succeeded in its goal to not be full of campy stereotypes. Instead, it's just full of very boring stereotypes. With talented writers, actors, and the hottest gay sex scenes American TV has ever seen, Looking, now in its second season, has never managed to feel human. It's stagey, forced, moralizing, one-dimensional, and boring. Somewhere between a bad instructional video trying to teach people how gayness works and a porn that spends far too much time on clunky dialogue between the sex scenes. And I cannot stop watching it. Like Mark Helgenberger piecing together DNA clues, I keep trying to figure out why this show couldn't get gay right. Why gay men, so good at exploring the inner lives of women and straight men, are so terrible at representing our own truth. Or if the show's marketing team has swindled me and everyone else, and Looking is, in fact, the greatest camp masterpiece since Showgirls. I made three... fine, respectable heterosexuals, though I don't know what happened in college, watch this show. Tell me your reactions.
I mean, you had warned me that it was going to be like watching paint dry. And as I tweeted back to you last night, I felt like that was a gross understatement. I mean, provided it's just one episode, and especially with HBO, I try not to judge an entire show on the basis of just one episode, let alone the first episode. But it was really boring. I just did nothing. You're right. Nothing happened. It wasn't really funny. It wasn't really dramatic. And as someone who used to live in San Francisco, and I know the neighborhoods, I know the bars are shooting in for the most part. It's just such a – I mean, not that San Francisco isn't very white in many ways, but it's so white it makes the Friends New York look like The Wire's Baltimore. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Well, there's the interesting thing that Looking is so proud of itself for showing beardy, dirty – gay guys who aren't wearing pastels and all of that. But for all of that, it's still a beardless twink, aging twink, but beardless white twink is who they want you to identify with because that's how the world works. I really was excited to have Margaret and Oliver particularly watch the show because you guys have different sensibilities from me. And I'm trying to figure out why people might like this show. If it's atmosphere, if it's lack of artificial stakes, some people, not very many people watched it. But Margaret, what?
Well, I watched the first episode of the second season, the one where they're in the woods and they go party in there. And there was something about it that I felt like they were doing the Sex and the City thing where there's like each kind of character. You know, there's the Samantha and there's the Carrie and that kind of breakdown. But then those characters are not fleshed out enough so that they pop out of that kind of role. So I was disappointed in that, where I just felt like the writing, just on a character level, is really flat. Like, who are these guys? Like, who can I grab onto? They're all kind of awash.
The AV Club's review said, nobody writes better naturalistic dialogue than Michael Lannon. And I was so pissed off, because the dialogue is so frequently, we are in a canoe. I did not know that there was a gay beach here. Look at all the bears on that beach. We are in a canoe. Like, we are going to take Molly. Is Molly ecstasy? Molly is ecstasy. I have just taken Molly. Like, I feel like fourth graders wrote a shitty porn.
Yeah, oddly enough, I found when they got to the sex scenes, I was like, okay.
But then they pull
away.
That's
pretty good. Yeah.
Like, you can show me. You can show me a blowjob.
Right.
I mean, you're not going to make me show me a penis.
I can see thrusting. I can handle thrusting.
Yeah. There was no butt sex in that first episode.
Oh, there was a little bit of butt sex.
There was a butt sex.
Really wouldn't be comfortable with that.
I watched the first episode of season two. There was some butt sex.
Yeah, they didn't get to butt sex until later in season one.
It's like Sopranos. You have to wait midway through to really get where the action is.
And there are moments where...
there was against a tree butt sex.
Yes, he watched a different episode.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Just wanted to clarify.
There's the excitement of like having conversations on a TV show that I don't get to watch on a TV show. Like later in season one, Patrick is having a conversation with this guy, Richie, about bottoming. And is sort of insisting that he doesn't want to bottom. And Richie sort of like calls him on it in a way that's like sweet and adorable and gives you almost a sense that you might be getting to a girlsy place of these people, of these terrible people being called on their shit.
Mm.
But like, it just never happens.
But see, this is my problem with it, that I don't want to just shit on looking. All I'm saying is that I grew up in San Francisco. This was, you know, for the most part, a part of my lifestyle. I have a lesbian aunt, you know, hung out with her in multiple places all over San Francisco that were very, you know, lesbian related. And then a lesbian affiliated. And then I also grew up around gay men. I had them in my family. My mom was friends with them. You know, she lost some friends. So there's that part where I really feel like this allegiance towards, like this Harvey Milk, you know, being around all the bears, growing up, you know, going to the Castro, spending Halloween in Castro, always being around this diversity. I don't feel like there's anything new to mine for myself, but I do like how it makes me feel like I'm at home, because it makes a lot of use of its environment, them going to Russian River, wearing a world championship Giants hat. But then, like, I don't know.
Real gay guys are more fun than that.
I know that. That's why I'm saying, who the F are these clowns that you're making me watch? Because I don't like them. They're the kind of gays that I generally don't hang out with.
Oliver.
Well, I'm wondering, and you were alluding to this before, Guy, that perhaps because there is such a tradition in television and Hollywood of just overly done campy gayness, that maybe this show is trying to go too far in the other direction to just erase all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But for a comedy slash drama, again, I'm just judging off the pilot. It wasn't very funny.
No.
It wasn't very dramatic.
I
just can't get, what is this supposed to be about?
And they're not fully formed characters.
Right,
they're
right.
Like literally four thought processes of the same dude.
It's so weird because like, the guy who Andrew Hay, who made it, made a movie called Weekend that's essentially the same kind of like slow, very well lit. It's attractive, subtle lighting, sort of like presentation. But because it's a movie where he has to get something done in 90 minutes, it's an interesting, cute little story about two gay guys having an affair, and one of them, affair, like it's Dynasty. where, you know, one of them is less comfortable with being gay and is having to sort of like figure that out. And it's interesting. I feel like this TV show is running scared from anything it seems too faggy. So it is never real. And I'm interested, sort of non-white people in this room, the ways
sorry, Margaret.
Pencils down.
You're a lady, which is the thing.
Thank you.
Sort of like the interesting difference of having minority cultures represented on television. And I mean, I'm sure there must be things that ring false and ring untrue, because it's usually a room that's at least got half white people in it who are writing them. I feel like there are different issues inherent in gay representation just because we're so...
Exactly.
Because we are about hiding. There's a way that if your skin color is different, some things are going to be out on the table. Where gay...
Like they have to go to Russian River.
Yeah.
To what, you know, if you're from NorCal, you know that's like sort of the new gay Mecca, the gay Palm, the northern Palm Springs. And it's like...
No, it's trashy as shit.
It is a national park.
You clearly haven't spent enough time in Palm Springs to know that same appellation could apply to that too. But okay.
Well, now I forgot my thought.
That's
why you shouldn't wake and bake.
I just think that there is a fear that if I'm only going to be able to put this in Jewish terms, if the goyim see how we really behave, mm-hmm. then they're going to judge us.
But that's where my thought comes back. Being Mary Jane is a show on BET, and it stars Gabrielle Union, and she is a very successful African-American professional woman. She has her own home. She has her own car. She's dating a married man. She's navigating her career. And at no point do I feel like I don't identify with this woman. I identify with her. And then on to that point, she does little things that let me know I'm with you, that whole I'm with you girl thing, where it's like I have to be a certain way in the professional environment, but behind closed doors I wrap my hair, it gets nappy, it does all this, you know, like there's I like that, juxtaposition. What I don't see with them is any juxtaposition. Like I just, you know, you didn't need to do Molly first episode to show how crazy you can get. Like, we get it. Like, I think now everybody more or less knows, if you're watching HBO, you know about gay culture.
It's just so flat and kind of moralizing.
Right.
Like, they are so proud of themselves for the sex. They're so proud of themselves for the drugs. But then it always has to be, oh, but that's a bad thing. Oh, but the guy who does too much sex and drugs, he passes out on the streets.
Right.
You know, I think it's interesting, though, as a woman, how many times there have been shows where there is a gay kind of... There's a gay writer, there's a gay perspective filtered through a woman.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, Sex and the City, I always felt like as a woman watching that, I could feel the hand of the gay, the gayness on it,
yes.
You know? Like, Samantha, to me, is entirely a gay man.
Right.
Like, that's a gay man kind of persona.
And the show got gayer by the season.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
But there's something so misogynistic and, like, there's something so weird about us feeling like we have the right to go and tell a woman how she behaves.
Yes.
But are scared to do it with a gay guy. And the thing is that, like, I've been in writer's rooms where a guy told me, you're the woman writer. And it's like, no, I can't do that. I don't know how that works. My favorite story on Happy Endings, first season, they had the gay character and they were so proud of this gay character for he's gay, but not gay like that. He's, you know, just a regular dude. And then there was one joke that just, and I liked the character. And then there was a joke that rested entirely on the premise that two gay guys, while butt fucking, can't look each other in the eyes. And I was like, oh my God. Like, this is an entire room full of people who are shaping this character, mm-hmm. who is representing homosexuality to America. And they just don't know how.
Saying he can't have intimacy.
Yes. I mean, it's sort of weird. I didn't realize that people thought that.
Yes. Yes.
Did anybody watch The L Word?
It was amazing.
I watched it a little bit.
Okay. Because, I also love The L Word. And mm-hmm. I think the difference, if I were to compare these shows, is mm-hmm. that The L Word, when it comes to the characters, they still are fitting into kind of those tropes, mm-hmm. but they have such charismatic actors. It just, it breaks out. I mean,
they're
like Catherine Manning and... Jennifer Beals. I mean, I could just watch those two actresses alone, do whatever they want.
Well, a thing that was interesting about The L Word is it was rooted in sort of a mythological lesbian world that doesn't exist, of like this like high-end lesbian club that they were always at.
Right.
That it was
okay.
Like
chic West
FYI,
Hollywood.
FYI, and this is as a straight
exist,
woman
though,
that
think.
Exists. That yeah. was full. Like that was.
Tell me where
I've
in Los Angeles.
Well, the thing is that they keep closing all these lesbian bars, according yes. to my lesbian girlfriends. But there was this one place where we go and watch the show,
yes.
and it was full on. An L Word episode at the club. It was literally like lesbian Disneyland.
Small shift of gears, but to me, the thing about Looking too is it feels almost like a parody of what a prestige HBO comedy looks like these days. And that when's the last, I mean, I think, you know, HBO on the drama tip is still mostly killing it. But when's the last time there was a real, you know, a half hour comedy on HBO you really wanted to watch? I feel like FX with You're the Worst, Transparent on Amazon, everyone else is doing HBO prestige comedies better than HBO is.
Oh, that's
right
a great point. I mean, the thing is like, development execs in comedy are now always pushing you towards what's the relationship, what's the drama, what are the stakes. And like so much work is being done on that that nobody's writing jokes. And
I mean, really, I kept expecting, you know, one of those David Fincher, Trent Reznor ambient soundtracks to come in during Looking because it had the aesthetic of it.
Totes.
And it would have made it so much more interesting.
Cool.
Like just throw some like creepy ambient, you know, Nine Inch Nails type shit underneath there. I don't know.
The thing that is missing from Looking is any sense of self-awareness or awareness of your own ridiculousness or the things that gay guys have to learn to be.
Right.
And to me, it is kind of gross and offensive that we still live in a world that is sort of saying, oh, that is a wrong thing that happens to gay guys and shouldn't happen. It is, to me, the beauty of our culture. Like, it is the thing that we've got that's good. And that this show lacks that means I have to bring it, which means I enjoy nothing more than talking shit about this show on Twitter and stuff, which kind of makes it an amazing camp experience. Like, it is...
It's a shared experience.
Well, it's showgirls. It's a thing that does not realize how stupid and unreal it is.
But yet it doesn't have that kind of camp appeal that showgirls has, where it's like, it's so ridiculous and over the top. I mean, there's nothing over the top about the
show.
It's so subdued. It's like frightened. It's scared to sort of break out and be something.
It's not proud. It is ashamed of who and what it is. But also, Margaret, subtle camp can be the most fun camp.
Teach me. What is
little camp? You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be back with musical recommendations and a special guest right after this.
Hi, I'm Brian Fernandez, a.k.a. Sonny D, producer of Jordan Jesse Go.
I'm Lindsay Pavlis, producer of Wham Bam Pow.
We're the stars of Maximum Fun's first web video series, Brian and Lindsay Will Totally Eat That.
Someone throws us a snack, we eat it, and then we rate it on a scale from yummy to crummy.
We've recorded a pilot, and we're raising funding for the series on Kickstarter until February 20th.
And if we receive enough backers, we will receive a huge challenge grant from our friends at Hover.com.
Go to MaximumFun.org/Totesy for more info or find us on Kickstarter.
Question for you.
Shoot it at me.
You gonna eat that?
Totally.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in studio are the regular panelists.
Margaret Wappler.
Winter Mitchell.
Oliver Wang.
And a special guest,
Jesse Thorne.
Yay!
Woohoo! Executive producer.
Great leader. Here you are referred to as great leader of Max Fun.
I'm proud to be so. You know, guys, I was thinking a lot about the show, and I thought I would love to contribute something on microphone. And I figured if I was going to contribute something on microphone, it should probably be a signature segment. And so in thinking about what my signature segment could be, I thought about, you know, what's my role? Well, you know, when I step into this room, I'm the only, you know, straight, heterosexual white guy. And so I thought,
we can smell the privilege.
Like, what do I know, you know, better than anything else? And of course, the answer is racism.
Enlighten us.
So I have decided to make my signature segment That Sism.
Okay.
Also known as hashtag That Sism.
Okay.
This is named in tribute. I used to be a habitué of the culture message boards at OKPlayer.com. And in a thread, if someone would post a story about something in popular culture that seemed like it was racist, someone else would just post underneath it That Sism. And so I have I've got a timely topic for this week's That's Ism. I asked people on Twitter what pop culture celebrations, misbegotten celebrations of Martin Luther King Jr. Day touched their lives the most deeply.
Oh, thank God you're coming up with
this. Think, Oliver, I think it was you that posted on Facebook yesterday about the NBA celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. Day by 12 12 games. There's no greater way to honor the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. than by making everybody work on a holiday.
And mostly black men, but yeah, exactly. Okay.
But I got some really wonderful stuff. Matt Murray, who's at That Matt Murray on Twitter, was nice enough to send me a picture of his Star Wars calendar for Monday, the 19th of January, which, of course, features Lando Calrissian giving a thumbs up.
Damn. I mean, honestly, I will defend that just because racially integrating a sci-fi movie was a bold step in 1981.
There's no black people in space. Okay, that wasn't a personal choice. I think we want to go to where the life goes.
On Twitter, at TreyCoolX, who's I don't know what his real name is. His Twitter name is Genial Black Man. Thank you, Genial Black Man, was kind enough to share with me the Seattle Seahawks update for Martin Luther King Day.
Taken down.
Which was removed, yes, but not before it was posted.
Indeed.
Oh, God.
Not during some sort of review process that they should probably institute now.
Right.
It featured the Seahawks quarterback, Russell Wilson, who is, I believe, African-American, correct?
Last time I checked, Jess.
It says it's a picture of Russell Wilson crying. He's in tears. I don't know if they're happy tears because of the remarkable comeback victory in the NFC Championship game.
Yes, that would be the case. Yes.
The picture features a caption, in the image, the kind of thing you might post on Facebook that says, quote, "Take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step," unquote. From Martin Luther King Jr., of course, talking about the NFC Championship game.
He always waited.
And the truly magical part about this Twitter update is that, when you post a picture on Twitter, you can still type some stuff in. They hashtagged it MLK Day, which I thought was a nice tribute to the day, and then also wrote, "We shall overcome the 19-3 deficit in the NFC Championship game.
The Packers, white supremacy, pretty much interchangeable, I suppose. I don't know.
Now, I just wonder what ends up happening to these people once they tweet it.
Do they get...
You tell us.
You're a social media expert.
Yes.
No, because I don't want to, ish on my industry, but I know that some things are done just to be done. Okay.
Oh, seriously?
Yes, and that
you're
there are
kidding
some...
me. In the social media consultancy industry, some people do things just
by
to
the
do
way,
things.
That was just worth my hourly rate for that revelation. No, I think that sometimes people just want to do things because they know that it will get likes, and I know that that is an attempt at strategy. However, I also know that some of these interns that they hire to do this stuff aren't.
Social media is always being done by a 24-year-old.
Right. They're not trained.
There's something really beautiful. This was the final one, and this was the one that actually set it all off for me. It was actually posted by Bill Corbett, the great comedy writer and Riff Tracks superstar, one of the sweetest guys in the world, and a fellow straight white guy. Shout out to Bill Corbett. He posted a tweet that also has been deleted, sadly. I want to know if anyone took a screen cap of it, but I saw it with my own eyes last night. It was from our friends at Fatburger.
Yay.
It's, of course, a popular fast food chain here in Southern California and across the nation. They wrote, "Paying tribute today to the legendary Martin Luther King Jr. at his memorial in D.C., and the photograph that accompanied it is a really beautiful picture of the new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, which is a big sculpture of Martin Luther King, and I believe it's white granite or something like that.
Let me guess, there was a burger in it.
There's just a bag of fat burger and a giant fat burger cup foregrounded in this picture. What I like about it is that it so purely distills the craven. They don't even bother to make any connection at all besides just putting Fatburger in a picture
right.
with Martin
just
Luther King
Jr. placement above all.
I'm going to defend this. I'm going to say that it's part of...
Here we go.
Part of making something a national holiday is like integrating it into our infrastructure. I mean, somebody has that joke about how 30 years from now, you're going to be getting half price mattresses on 9/11. And like,
Chris Rock.
Yes. And he's somebody.
Yeah.
but like there is something interesting about that integration into our infrastructure that does sort of reflect, I mean, I am, of course, not saying that the fight for civil rights is over, but that it is something that is ingrained in us enough now.
You know what? I know a little something about the fight for civil rights, and it's definitely over.
Look,
we won!
When people bitch about gay pride parades getting too corporatized, I'm always like, if my parents can't love me, at least I can know that my bank does.
Everybody, but listen, this is the thing. Even
the look on Oliver's face right now.
But even, you know, my people made some foibles yesterday. I know that I was listening to K-Day while I was driving to the gym, and they said, you know, celebrate, you know, they have the guy's voice celebrating Martin Luther King's Day on K-Day. And then it's like Splash Waterfalls by Ludacris, which is about really lubricated sex. So I'm just saying that, and not everybody is always... It's a really good time to promote something. There's clubs that have
ladies'
free
before. Maybe they knew something about Coretta that you don't.
Maybe they Jesus, guy.
You know what?
Don't put me in that position.
It's funny that you mentioned the announcers on K-Day or your local hip-hop station. I'm sure this is something that you probably listen to hip-hop radio once in a while too, Oliver.
Yeah.
But I think a future episode of That SZM may be focused on the white guy that is always the God voice on the hip hop station.
Yes.
Like the sort of like
3,000
trailer
watts.
The trailer voice guy,
right.
who's saying
the
like
over, the hip hop overlord.
Gentlemen, no jerseys, no sneakers. Ladies get in free. I mean, K-Day Friday nights.
Shout out to Theo Mizuhara. When the blackest voice is out there, except he's J.A., so, you know.
So if you have SZM that you'd like to share with me and our panel, I'll be here every few weeks, tweet it with the hashtag ThatSZM, SZM being spelled C-I-S-M, or share it, of course, in the Pop Rockets Facebook group, which is very lively, thanks to the efforts of the people in this room right this very moment. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, is it equal opportunity racism?
It. Oh, any kind of racism, yeah, but, you know, so.
Because I'm definitely going to say something, Jesse, if I feel like this is acceptable racism on behalf of the black people.
Right.
Okay.
I'm just going to let you know this is actually acceptable. And it's been like the law and order. Sorry, I motion and move this whole conversation to never.
Great news, Winter. On this show, you speak for all black people.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
You get to decide.
We all have
amazing.
We have ambassadorial status for the groups that we represent.
Yes.
We're fucking potentates. All right, you guys. This is Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio is this lady.
Hello, I'm Margaret.
And another lady.
Hi, I'm Winter.
And a dude.
Oliver.
He's leaning against the wall, smoking a cigarette, being really cool right now.
The amount of swagger being thrown by Oliver Wang at every moment just it makes me feel for all of those little freshmen who have to sit in your class and just fan themselves.
Yes.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we'll be asking our panel, what's your current jam? And since I'm already running out of favorite songs, I'm going to broaden the definition of jam out to anything great in pop culture. So we still need to figure out how this segment works. But for this week, my jam is the Twitter accounts of my fellow panelists here. Oliver Wang is at SoulSides. In recent past, one of my favorites was, what stands out most about Almost Famous Now? That Rolling Stone used to employ a fact checker.
Ouch.
Who plays a prominent role in the film. It's like she has a seat at the table with Jan Wenner, and I'm like, did that actually really ever happen? And clearly that's not happening now.
Okay,
so
it was the best. It was the best. Where was the rape scandal?
UVA.
It was the best UVA rape scandal joke that I read on Twitter. And you know how I love a good rape scandal joke. Also, were you watching Almost Famous at the time that it crossed your mind?
Yeah.
Okay, I love that judo approach to jokes when just sort of like the right facts flow at you and then you are able to just sort of like push them back at people. It was beautiful work. Next up, Winter Mitchell, Queen K-W-E-E-N everything.
Yeah.
Winter and I have very similar approaches to many things, but Twitter is one of them, where it's just sort of participatory kibitzing in our lives. And I really enjoyed, trust me, the moment I get a ring, you'll be begging Mark Zuckerberg to change the Facebook interface. And Edge Rank. I don't know what that is. I'm all over your timeline. I've sat idle patiently, liking your babies, your food, your engagements, friending this boyfriend, the last boyfriend. You're going to hate me. And it was just such a fun rant of you, like, coming to a moment of self-awareness.
Yeah.
And sharing.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, I feel like I've done a lot of courtesy follows and a lot of courtesy endorsements in social media for others. And now I'm understanding the power of my voice, quite frankly.
Hear her roar.
Hear me roar.
The power of your voice to complain about future you.
Exactly.
And finally, at Margaret Wappler, did the Academy overlook the Lego movie because there weren't enough white Lego men in it? I mean, that's just some...
I'll be here all week.
Ouch.
That's a fucking joke. That's a fucking joke right there. All right. That's enough of me forcing this to not be about music because I'm a terrible person. Oliver, what's your jam?
Frank Ocean covering Aaliyah, covering the Isley Brothers.
Ooh. Whoa. Meta leaders.
Can we hear some of that?
When I feel what I feel, sometimes it's hard to tell.
I miss him. I miss them.
You may not be in the mood to learn what you think you know.
So we already know that Frank Ocean can do the falsetto thing really well if you've listened to Agent Orange. We've also been starved for new music from him, and he dropped this on what would have been Aaliyah's birthday. And, you know, it was always a great Aaliyah song, again, covering the Isley Brothers. But having Ocean do Aaliyah's version of the Isley song is somehow just perfect. And this song doesn't – it's not over-adorned. It just is what it is. It's his voice, and it's lovely.
Also, that's a man who knows how to work turquoise. Winner, what's your jam?
My jam is I Want to Be Where the Boys Are. That's what it's called, right? Mm-hmm. By the Runaways. And it's dedicated to Kim Fowley, who died last week. And he discovered the Runaways. And the reason why I dedicate this to him is because the Runaways were introduced to me by my Aunt Kim. And they were, and then through the Runaways, I learned about the Go-Go's, and then I learned about the Bangles, and it just sort of, I've always had a fondness for, like, girls who can rock and bands that can rock and girls who write their own music, and, you know, being a little black girl growing up listening to, you know, punk pop bands was, like, not the thing.
Yeah, as a black woman, you're supposed to have an abusive husband who writes and produces for you, right?
Oh. Really? Jesus!
All right, let's hear this song.
This guy.
Wild in the streets, barely alive. Mommy's always telling me, stay inside. Don't you hang around with those young boys. Soon you'll be loving them, they're all my toys. I want to be where the boys are.
Girls who play drums, girls who, like,
this makes me just
scream
want to thrash
and yell.
Some
yeah,
boys right
thrash
now.
Thrash some boys right now. Like, that's what I used to listen to. In addition to all the other stuff I was supposed to listen to. Whitney Houston, Madonna.
What pulled this into your consciousness this week?
Because Kim Fowley died.
Okay. I'm just wondering if...
And I could have picked Cherry Bomb, but that would have been really obvious, and I'm not obvious.
I just... as somebody who doesn't pay attention to music, I'm noticing rumblings in a direction of... girl rockiness with the Slater Kenny return and all of that. Is this like, is a storm a brewing?
I think so. We need a new Lilith Fair, don't you think?
Wepler. Oh, wow. Yeah. Bring it on.
Yeah.
Quick shout out to Evelyn McDonald, who's at LMU, who wrote a fantastic book about the runway. It's called Queens of Noise.
Did you just put a plug inside
I did.
My
I did.
She's
my
fantastic.
Jam?
She's
I
worth
did.
Plugging, yeah.
For an academic work.
No, she's actually she's a music journalist, but she happens to teach journalism at LMU. So
cool. Margaret, what's your jam?
My jam this week is from a London-based producer, this guy named James Greenwood. This music, this song that we're gonna hear, it's called Answer. It's from his debut. I love it when a producer makes music. It's so clean, elegant. This guy has that kind of touch. It's also great if you like Depeche Mode, New Order, that kind of whole electronica strain that happened in the 80s with the sort of art pop fused into it. So for me, this is just really tantalizing. I think he has a great ear for texture. And this debut is exciting to me, but I also want to see what happens next. I feel like he's going to have to like up his game just a little bit more. But all the same, let's hear a little bit of Answer. I love that synthesizer swoosh.
Entered into earnest eyes.
I feel like I made it to an underground level on a game from, like, the mid-90s.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
This could totally play behind looking right here.
Yes. I mean, literally,
Molly
not
scene right there.
If...
Molly scene.
It'll be an entourage before that.
Closing words?
Yeah.
From me?
Final thoughts, Wappler.
Oh, final thoughts. I mean, I guess I would just compare this to, if I were to go later, I would think about, like, XX, Caribou... I love the silkiness of this whole jam, and the whole album at large is just very, like, it'll slide right into you.
Like, like two guys fucking against a redwood. All right, you guys, you've been listening to more butt sex jokes than Pop Rocket has ever given you before. So it's Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Also thanks to Aerolic, Melijay, Andy, and The Statesman for their 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, whoever gave us a 1-star review. Actually, no. We appreciate all reviews.
We love our haters, Guy. I've talked to you about
that.
The
haters are going to hate.
Ainers going to ain't.
Please get the word out. Tell everyone you know and love about our fun little podcast. And get in touch with us on Twitter at PRPod. Join the Pop Rocket Podcast Facebook group. Winter has been doing a lot of opinionating. And even great leader Jesse Thorne has been stopping by to throw down with some stuff. Here's something we'd like your opinion on this week after us making all those butt sex jokes. Would you prefer a clean show without swearing, or should we keep it blue? I believe we all know what my opinion is. We will post show notes every week at MaxFun.org. We are a production of listener-supported MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the very charming Mr. Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.